You know, the liquid crystal screen has to have a polarizer in front of it. What they did was they actually made a metalized, with high resistance, a metalized polarizer that was conductive. And they attempted and continue to attempt to use that as a bit of a Faraday shield.
From your point of view, Eric, was that reasonably successful? Did it knock down the noise by 10 dB?
Well, I don't know by how much, but I know that they're kind of effective, especially I was working on one day, and we'll pull the polarizer off of it, and, you know, put that out of the case, and, you know, watch the noise go up. So, yeah, it's effective. It's whether it's 3 dB or 6 dB or 10 dB, I couldn't tell you. I can't imagine it to be too much because, you know, it's not like a solid piece of metal.
What did you see on that screen, Eric, when you removed the polarizer in front of the screen?
Almost nothing, and a lot of light.
I thought so. One of the big mistakes I had, my Hewlett-Packard Model 28 handheld calculator. Quite often I was using it in the graphic mode, getting a beautiful graph on the screen. I wanted to make a Xerox copy of that graph and ship it to people, so I held that screen in front of a Xerox copier. It never would reproduce. It was always, the screen would always show up black. The screen was some kind of a polarizer, and the light coming from the Xerox machine shining into that polarizer came back as a purely black screen. There was nothing there to see. What's your guess as to what was going wrong? I'm pretty sure the screen on the Hewlett-Packard handheld calculator was polarized. That's how it turned from black to white. But why in the world would the Xerox machine not be able to take that picture that my eye could see? Got a guess, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Did that display have its own backlight, or did it only work with room light?
The Hewlett-Packard 28 has no backlight. It works on room light. And so the light was coming from the Xerox machine, just like the light was coming from the room when my eye was looking at the screen. But on the Xerox machine, it turned out pure. The screen looked black.
And was the Xerox machine, it's illuminated because it only lights up a line's worth, literally, of page, so to speak. Was it green or white?
I think it was white, but I think you're going to tell me that the screen, that the light coming from the Xerox machine was itself already probably linearly polarized. Therefore, the screen on the computer could no longer differentiate it into black and white, is my guess. Over to you, Eric.
The power supply should give the man a cigar. There's also the other thing is that the power supply running those lights, moving, I don't know what frequency they're moving at. They're at some high frequency rate. And now, if you go on how does the liquid crystal work and why do you need the polarizer in front of it, you have two different things going on at two different rates. So you've got the light heading towards your screen, it has to reflect back. Don't forget that the liquid crystal is flipping back and forth at something like a 30 or 50 kilohertz rate. Is that how it works? And you've got those conflicts going on.
Yes, two different radar rates, probability of intercept problem, polarization problem, difficult problem. Okay. So, I'm pretty sure Santo is going to bring his transistorized radio to his showroom the next time he buys a television set. And so, right now your choices are to convince the wife to turn off the television set during your favorite HF operating periods and or buy another set. Next person on our list was Tommy, Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Golf Delta. You've got it, Tommy. K2RIW in the TechNet. One more call. Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Golf Delta. Tommy, who signed in earlier. Are you still with us, Tommy? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, looks like we got a little bit of extra time before we go over to the space report. Anybody within the sound of my voice?
It is it.
Who was that?
Oh, it's just me. And on the subject of plasmas, by now, most of them are starting to reach end of life because the gas doesn't last forever. K2RIW, K2J.
AC2IS, query.
AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
This is Bill, AC2IS. You were telling me to go ahead, is that right?
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. You're number one on the runway right now. You got it, Bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. See, I was thinking, I think you were talking about slot antennas last week. I came up with a question about that. I believe that if you're doing a strip antenna that's not a slot antenna, it's the length of the strip that matters if you're using it as a sort of a dipole. And the width will increase the Q, but does not affect the length of the antenna. I think that's right. But then that makes me think, okay, if you're doing a slot antenna, the same size, same dimensions, it should be the same frequency, but I can't figure out why that would be the case exactly. If you made the slot very wide, right, if we translate back to the strip antenna, you should not be changing the frequency of the antenna by making it wider, but the distance between the two endpoints where you're connecting your feed line to the slot antenna, that's changing. Why does that not change the frequency of the antenna? AC2IS.
Yeah, what Bill is referring to is either last week or the week before. We were talking about the duality of antenna types. That duality was originally discovered in the optical world by a Mr. Babinet, B-A-B-I-N-E-T, Babinet. You Google those words, you'll find out Babinet's principle, Babinet's rule. And what it literally translates to with reference to radio antennas, and his Babinet's rule was really with reference to particles in the air being hit with a light wave, and how does the frequency response of the reflection of particles in the air is what Babinet's rule was originally invented on, or discovered. Loosely defined, if I take an ordinary antenna, like a dipole, it is a piece of wire, it is a conductor, where you've got the left side of the dipole, the right side of the dipole, if you're feeding it in the center, the conventional way, that's the only way to feed it, and the wire has a certain length, giving you a resonant length, and a certain diameter, which gives you the Q of the antenna. As you make the diameter of the wire in wavelengths larger and larger, you might start off with a thousandth of a wavelength, go down to a 500th, and a 100th, and a 50th, and so on. The dipole becomes more and more broadband, and to reestablish resonance, when you make the wire of the dipole thicker and thicker, to reestablish resonance, you have to make the wire a little bit shorter. Let me drop. It's a crazy phenomenon that happens with wire, that if you make the wire very large in diameter, the resonant length is now a little bit shorter, and the bandwidth of the antenna becomes broader. The Q becomes lower. Babinet's rule says that everywhere you had insulator, which used to be air, you make that a sheet of metal. Everywhere you used to have metal, which was the antenna, you make that air. You've now got a slot covered in your cut in your big sheet of metal. Babinet's rule says that when you do an exact inverse antenna, substitute metal for air and air for metal, and you have a big enough sheet of metal, the new slot antenna will have the exact same resonant frequency, the exact same antenna pattern, the exact same Q, beam width, bandwidth, and whatever. The only thing that changes is that your horizontal piece of wire as a dipole with a horizontal slot is going to be vertically polarized instead of horizontally polarized. So the polarization changes, but everything else stays the same. Pattern, beam width, bandwidth, resonant length, and so on. So as you make the slot wider and wider, it becomes lower in Q, and you have to make the slot a little bit shorter in order to reestablish resonance. And for every slot antenna, there's a magical position near one of the short circuit ends where you have the piece of wire coming from the center conductor of your transmission line. Let me drop. The piece of wire goes across the gap. The shield of the transmission line, you ground it on one side of the sheet of metal. The piece of wire goes across the gap, the center conductor, and touches the other side of the sheet of metal. And there's a magic position somewhere near the short-circuited end. If you're building a slot antenna at 900 megacycles, and it might be in the vicinity of 4.5 inches long, maybe 1 inch from one end is where you're going to feed it, and you'll see a 50-ohm impedance. Feed it closer to the short-circuit end, you'll see 20 ohms impedance. Feed it right at the center of the slot, and you'll see 1,000 ohm impedance. So there's a magic position that gives you different impedances. By the same token, with your dipole, feed it in the center, ordinary dipole, you've got roughly 70 ohms. As you start feeding the dipole closer and closer to one end, and eventually you feed the dipole literally at the tip, you'll see something like 1,500 ohms. So there's a similar characteristic. The impedance changes in the inverse manner between the ends of the slot versus the ends of the dipole. So there's a lot of duality here. Since there are roughly 5,000 kinds of ordinary antennas, and almost all of those antennas can be built in the inverse manner by Babinet's rule as a slot, you could say there's another 5,000 kinds of antennas. ACQIS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, thank you for that. So the thing that I got wrong there was that the length of the strip antenna does get shorter when you increase its width. So keeping on going with this thought experiment, I believe that the slot antenna, basically it's sort of, you're measuring the perimeter of the slot, the length of the sides. And that should add up to, I guess, a half wavelength, something like that. So I'm assuming then the same rule applies to if you're doing a strip antenna. So if you are, for example, making the wire that was sort of infinitesimally narrow, now you're making it an inch wide, you should be shortening that strip antenna by about a half an inch from, compared to the straight wire antenna. Would that be correct? And then another question, you can do a slot antenna that's fed in the center of the slot, right? Can you equally or just as well make sort of a half slot antenna? Where you sort of cut a chunk out of into the edge of a piece of metal, and so you don't have a full slot that's fully enclosed by metal, but it's open on one edge. Can you feed that as sort of a half dipole and still have that work well? AC2IS.
Absolutely, and that is a slot equivalent of a ground plane antenna. And let's see now. Will it have a, yes, it'll have an antenna pattern very similar to a ground plane antenna. And there are various versions of that. Your inverted F antenna on sheet metal comes close to that. So if you build an antenna at 900 megacycles, building it out of copper foil, you can easily make it almost any width you want. And as you make it wider, I'm hearing a little bit of music in the background. Eric probably knows about that. A little bit of music is coming through the audio system, Eric. You can make it easily wide. And so making a 900 megacycle three-element Yagi antenna out of copper foil is something that I did a lot of work with RFID antennas, a three-element RFID antenna. Three-element Yagi hanging on the front of the Symbol 9000 product, the Model 9000 handheld RFID reader. That Yagi antenna has 6 dB of gain over isotropic. It's got more than 28 megacycles of bandwidth, and my definition of 28 megacycles of bandwidth is where the standing wave ratio is under 1.05 to 1. across 902 to 928 megacycles. That handheld 9000 series handheld reader, under good conditions, can read a tag at 22 feet. And the tag is thoroughly passive. A tiny little chip on the case of an RFID tag, 22 feet away, when it's mounted on a cardboard box, you can read it. So 6 dB of gain, and that's that sheet metal, that the copper foil is what the antenna was originally made of in the prototype stage, that eventually became a piece of stainless steel in the final product, with a rubber coating over the top of it, a fancy kind of rubber made by a company in Philadelphia, where the rubber was rated up to 60 hertz. After a whole bunch of testing, I discovered that the rubber, called Dynaflex, works beautiful at 900 megacycles. It's got extremely low insertion loss. Let me drop it. So if you've got a vector network analyzer connected to your antenna under test, and you're building these slots in the center or at the edge that you just described, Bill, on a piece of sheet metal, well, there's a zillion kinds of antennas. If you get a hold of a book called Frequency Selective Surfaces, I'm having trouble remembering the author's name, but it's a very famous book, you'll find all kinds of ways of taking a sheet of metal or a sheet of plastic and put pieces of copper foil on it and making step and repeat antennas, phased arrays of them, and you'd be amazed how many things will be an antenna. As long as your device being fed by a transmission line achieves resonance, artificially or real, in other words, it could be physically laid out in such a way that it represents a resonance at your favorite frequency. Let me drop. That would be direct resonance, or what I call artificial resonance. You've got some kind of an antenna tuner connected to the transmission line, hopefully a low-loss transmission line, feeding the antenna. Even though the antenna itself is non-resonant, you can force it into resonance. And as long as your structure, your radiating structure with its antenna tuner, resonates at your frequency, and as long as it's made out of low-loss materials, highly conductive metal and highly low-lossy dielectric materials supporting it, your antenna, in almost every case, can achieve nearly 100% radiation efficiency. Even that really yucky antenna that no longer has an external whip, that's buried deep inside of your cell phone case, as long as all the surrounding material is well shielded, that antenna inside of your cell phone can have nearly 100% efficiency, obvious by the fact that in order for that cell phone to be qualified, to be manufactured, shipped, and sold in the United States, it must meet certain requirements, and one of those requirements is total radiated power, TRP. So, by definition, it's going to have 100% efficiency. Some of the recent articles in the respected journals, Microwaves and RF Magazine, the author of the article says, because the antenna is now squeezed into a small space inside of the cell phone, the antenna has lost 10 dB of its performance. He said those words because he believed it. He didn't measure it. If it had 10 dB of extra loss, and he's saying that because the cell phone base stations are so high in performance, let me drop it. He's saying all the extra range is being remade up because of the cell phone performance, the cell phone base station performance. No way in hell. By the way, if the antenna had 10 dB of loss, like he's saying, that would really mean that of all the power you put into the antenna, 90% of it's turned into heat and only 10% of it's radiated. That's what 10 dB of loss means. He'd have a very hot case, both because of all the power going into the final amplifier, all the power coming out of the battery, and all of the loss of the antenna. He'd have a very hot cell phone in his hand. He'd be very unhappy with it. He believes that, but it's crazy. So, the yuckiest looking antenna in the world, made out of low-loss material, as long as it's resonant and well impedance matched at your frequency, can have nearly 100% efficiency, even though your eye tells you it's got the wrong shape, the wrong size, too small a fraction of a wavelength, can't possibly operate as an antenna. If you're smart enough, every slot in the sheet metal of your automobile, where the fender meets the body of the car, where the side view mirror meets the car, there's a zillion ways you can make a car have a beautiful set of antennas, and the car is plain clothes. You'd never know there's any antennas installed. AC2IS, KQIW in the deck net.
Okay, thank you for that. I didn't catch if you answered whether or not it was correct that if you make a strip antenna an inch wide, that it should probably be about a half inch shorter than its wire antenna equivalent. Is that right, AC2IS?
No, that is not right. How much the antenna becomes shortened as you make it wider is not a direct relationship of the width. It's a direct relationship of the wavelength. An antenna at 900 megacycles made a half inch wide, maybe you're going to shorten it by a quarter, 3/8 of an inch. An antenna made at 80 meters, where you made it out of copper foil, a couple of inches wide, you may have to make the antenna a foot shorter. It's a function of wavelength. So it's a certain percentage of the normal halfway. You're going to start off with a skinny antenna very close to a half wavelength long. Usually the number is 95%. So you calculate wavelength of your dipole, build 95% of it if you're building it out of a conventional width material. You start building it out of very wide materials, the number starts moving toward 90% of the length instead of 95%. So it's a function of wavelength and a percentage of wavelength of width. So it's not a direct relationship like you'd like to think, Bill. AC2IS, K2IW.
Okay. Is the reason for that, I think you're saying at higher frequencies you would have to shorten it more? Is the reason for that maybe because you're introducing, by making the strip wider, that it essentially the voltage is now moving in somewhat of a loop, AC2IS?
It is my guess that as you make the width of the copper foil for your UHF dipole wider, you get a greater amount of tip capacitance. And that is capacitive loading. There's a virtual top hat at the tips of the antenna. That is my belief as to the major mechanism for why it now must be made 90% of a half wavelength instead of 95% in order to be resonant. But reestablishing resonance, as long as you get the right kind of instrumentation, a simple standing wave ratio meter will do. And a tuning wand, a long wooden stick with a piece of copper foil on the end of it held near the tip of the antenna. It's like a blind man walking up a hill. The tilt of your feet tells you which way is uphill by looking at whether or not holding a piece of copper foil near the tip of your dipole makes the standing wave ratio get better or worse, tells you whether or not you've got to go higher or lower in frequency or longer or shorter. So you find out real fast. Establishing resonance with simple testing equipment is very easy, so don't worry about it. It doesn't have to be an exact calculation with three decimal places. Let me drop. Your other question is, where does the extra bandwidth come from? When I start building the dipole out of a strip of copper foil instead of a skinny piece of wire, why does it have lower Q? Why does it have lower Q and why does it have more bandwidth? The best answer I can guess at is that the RF energy decides to go down that copper foil, not always straight. At certain frequencies, it decides to go down there in a zigzag manner. And therefore, it's got multiple ways of traversing that length. It finds one of those ways and refines resonance. That's my guess as to what's happening, as to why it has greater bandwidth. I know there's a lot more than that going on. That's just a gut feel I've got for what's happening. But every antenna you can think of, you make the materials out of wide materials, you always develop greater bandwidth. As such, let me drop. WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. Kent, Britain. Dallas, Texas. Something plane. I can't think of the name of the town just outside of Dallas where he lives. But you Google WA5VJB.com. He has a whole series of printed circuit antennas at UHF frequencies that he sells. You try to make an antenna out of copper foil wider and wider. The extreme is you make two circles of copper foil, bring them close together, put a transmission line right at the point where they almost touch. That gives them an extremely broadband dipole. I think it covers an octave. So the extreme case of a really broadband dipole is two circles of conducting material brought close together, fed with the right kind of a balancing structure, right at the point where they become close together. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2IS here. Used some rationale for that would work for a strip antenna that, the RF signal, essentially the electrons bouncing back and forth on that strip can take sort of diagonal paths or something. You get different paths you can take, so the bandwidth gets wider because these different paths are different lengths. But that logic would not seem to work for the equivalent slot antenna unless maybe the electrons are sort of moving further out in your plate of sheet metal, sort of arcing in their path. And you would think that, that then you would not get this effect for a wider slot as opposed to a narrower slot, because why would the electrons not take the same arced path in a very narrow slot when they have got a very large sheet of sheet metal in either case, a large plane of sheet metal that they could traverse if they wanted to. Does that make sense, AC2IS?
I see the nature of your question there, Bill. Let's go one step deeper. Let's start off with that very large diameter, round dipole antenna. You decided, Mike, to make your dipole on 902 megacycles instead of this being roughly 5 or so inches long, made out of 18-gauge wire. You decided to make it out of a piece of copper tubing, a half inch in diameter. If you do that, it gets a lot more bandwidth, and you're going to have to make it a little bit shorter. Now let's look at the fields around that dipole while it's operating. The current flowing down the copper tubing has a certain amount of significant resonant current. The magnetic field is similar to the current is the direction of your thumb. Your fingers wrapped around the copper tubing represent where the magnetic field goes. In the case of a larger diameter piece of copper tubing instead of the 18-gauge piece of wire, the magnetic field is now much further out into space because it can't, by the skin effect, the E field and the H field is not inside of the copper tubing. Inside of the copper tubing, there's nothing. You've now forced the field to be further away from the antenna, a larger diameter of those magnetic lines of force in the dipole. Okay, let me drop. Now, by Babnitz rule, you build a very large slot in a sheet of metal to, again, a half-inch wide slot, where the slot is roughly 5 inches long, to be around 902 megs, maybe it's 6 inches, but it's in that ballpark. The larger slot now has a E field flowing from the near side to the far side of the slot, further out into space because the slot is bigger. So in the case of the real dipole, the magnetic field lines are further away from the axis of the dipole. And the fact that in the case of the slot, the E field lines are flowing further away from the axis of the slot. So in either case, you've got lines of force, E or H, further away from the axis when you make the antenna broader, whether it be slot or a real conductor. So by similar rules, with Babnitz rule, you're going to get greater bandwidth. That's some of what's going on. And those E-field lines flowing out in space on that wider slot have more different ways that they can flow. In close, further away, because you've got a great big slot launching a great big E-field. Can you picture that in three-dimensional space in your mind, Bill? AC2IS, K2IW, wait for the beeps, please.
I did have difficulty picturing that. We went from a strip antenna to a three-dimensional loop antenna, and I had difficulty switching over to the slot equivalent of this three-dimensional structure. Started imagining, okay, a solid block of metal that you drill the hole in to the same depth as your section of pipe, but then I don't think there's a way to feed your slot antenna at that point because the electrons would want to conduct, across the antenna instead of down to the end of the length of the antenna and back around. So maybe because my mind was busy with that, I didn't quite follow what you were saying, AC2IS.
Okay, an ordinary dipole in free space, I can build it out of a piece of 18-gauge wire, or I can build it out of and it's roughly 5 inches long, and I can build it out of a strip of copper that's a half-inch wide. In the case of this half-inch wide piece of copper, the H-field lines are much further out in space than they were with a piece of 18-gauge wire. And by the way, the half-inch wide piece of copper foil really is a two-dimensional equivalent of what I really should be doing. I should be building it out of a half-inch diameter piece of copper tubing. But the RF energy is a little bit blind. It can't see the difference between a half-inch diameter of copper tubing or a half-inch wide strip of copper foil. It acts almost the same. But in either case, the larger diameter has the H-field lines further out in space because they're... you can figure out where the lines are going by pointing your thumb along the wire in the direction where the current flows, wrapping your fingers around the antenna structure, and your fingers represent the lines where the H-field flows, and the H-field is a larger diameter out into space when you're using a larger diameter for the dipole. Let me drop. Now, when I build the slot equivalent of that, bear in mind that I can build the ordinary dipole out of a very thin sheet of copper foil, half-inch wide, and the RF energy thinks it's a round, circular object. It can't tell the difference between a half-inch diameter piece of tubing and a half-inch wide piece of copper strip. There's almost no difference in the way they act. The RF can't see the difference. Because in either case, it's a very small fraction of a wavelength of width. The RF doesn't have the resolution to tell the difference in cross-section between copper foil, half-inch wide, and copper tubing, half-inch diameter. It can't tell the difference. I now build the slot equivalent out of a flat sheet of copper foil, and I make a slot in the copper foil, but I don't make the slot a 16th of an inch wide. I make it a half inch wide slot in a thin sheet of copper foil for the slot antenna. Across that slot, there are E-field lines now. From the near side of the slot to the far side of the slot, you've now got E-field lines in space. And when the slot is a half inch wide instead of a 16th of an inch wide, the E-field lines are further out into space. So because the lines of field are further in space, H-field in one case, E-field in the other, but the lines of force, the lines of action, let's call it, are further out in space because it's, in either case, it's bridging a larger apparent antenna. Real strip of copper foil in the case of a dipole, real slot width in air in the case of a sheet metal slot antenna. That's part of the mechanism for why the bandwidth is greater. There's a lot more going on.
Repeater, timeout.
There's a lot more than that going on. but that gives you a little bit more of a hint of what's happening there, Bill. I wonder if you can see it now. In the case of the slot antennas, it was always a thin sheet of copper foil. We're just determining how wide is the slot and how long is the slot. The length of the slot gives me resonance, the width of the slot gives me bandwidth, and when I make the slot wider, I have to make the slot a little bit shorter to reestablish resonance in both cases. AC2IS, wait for the beeps, K2LAW.
So part of this, when we're talking about a strip antenna, or the talking about versus a solid antenna of the same diameter as your tube, that seems to touch on the conversation we had, I guess it was a couple months ago, where we talked about this sort of surface effect, right, with higher frequencies become more and more of your electrons end up being conducted in the surface of a conductor, and less and less, you know, when you go to DC, it could be carried throughout, I guess, but at high frequencies, everything is basically is being conducted in the center, and we were saying, I think, that essentially when you've got AC currents, essentially, the RF being, you know, very high frequency AC, that you're setting up essentially a magnetic field, and that this magnetic field is impeding the electron's motion in the center of the conductor and less so at the surface, so that's why all your conductivity is happening in the surface. Okay, so that makes sense for a solid conductor antenna or a tube of the same diameter or even a strip antenna, but when I think of a slot antenna, I don't understand why it is that the electrons want to stay very close to the slot. I can see, okay, if you've got a very wide slot, then sort of necessarily the electrons do want, you know, cannot be further in, right, because there's no conductor there. They have to be further out where the edge of the slot is. But if you have a narrow slot, why is it that the electrons, you know, don't just choose to go further out and take a wider path? Is there something different about the magnetic field here that's causing more impedance to the electrons further out away from the slot now and less in towards the edge of the slot? Not sure why that would be the case. AC2IS.
Okay, Bill, we're now going to have to go to the next step in the depth of what's really going on near the macroscopic level. When I've got that half-inch wide sheet of copper foil as a dipole, and it's roughly 5 inches long at 902 megacycles, maybe it's really 6 inches, but it's in that ballpark. If I now use any of the computer modeling programs and I plot something called J-field, in other words, where is the current really flowing? First of all, any kind of a conductor at most of the RF frequencies you and I care about. I don't care if it's an 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire. I don't care if it's a 6-meter antenna made out of a half-inch diameter aluminum tubing, 6-meter Yagi antenna. In almost all of the frequencies you and I care about, with reasonable conductors, because of the skin effect, for a whole bunch of crazy reasons, the RF energy rarely goes down more than 1/10,000th of an inch inside of the copper, inside of the conductor. So the nearest top 1/10,000th of an inch is doing all of the conducting on almost any of the metallic antennas you and I build at ham radio frequencies, HF frequencies, roughly 1/10,000th of an inch. Good round number. Okay? Now we take this copper foil at 900 megs, roughly 5.5 inches or so long, half inch wide, dipole, 900 megs, and by the J-field plotting of a good computer modeling program, I'll find that the majority of the current of resonance is flowing in the outer edge of the copper foil. I could whittle away the center of the copper foil. I could make the copper foil half inch wide.
Repeater, time out.
I could make the copper foil a half inch wide and whittle a slot down the center of the copper foil a quarter of an inch wide, because the J field plotting of that computer modeling program will show me that almost no current is flowing in the center of the copper strip, half inch wide, 5 to 1/2 inches long. Almost all the current is flowing in the outer perimeter. I could whittle away the copper in the center and almost nothing would change. All the current is flowing in the outer perimeter. Similar to what happens with the high frequency transistors when you have these finger-like structures, interstitially diffused finger structures. Again, all of the RF current is flowing in the outer perimeter. The reason why they use fingers as the gates of a FET transistor is because the current only flows in the outer perimeter. By using a whole bunch of fingers, you make a lot of perimeter. Okay, so once you realize that the copper strip, the current is only flowing near the outer edge of the copper strip, you now make the slot antenna a half inch wide out of copper foil. Let me drop. Again, all of the current is flowing further away from the axis because there's only air down that axis. The current is not flowing there. Because where you have a lot of current flowing in a dipole, the Dobnitz rule inverse characteristic is such that you have a lot of voltage across the slot. In the case of the foil dipole, in the center of the dipole, you've got a lot of current. In the case of the slot antenna, near the center of the slot, 4 1/2 inches from each, 2 1/2 inches from each side, you've got a lot of voltage across the slot. The voltage makes a very strong E field across that half inch gap. Those E field lines go out into space quite a bit further. When the slot was made only a 1/16 of an inch wide, the E field lines are very strong, very close to the slot. When the slot is a half inch wide, the E field lines, by definition, are much further out into space, because where the E field lines touch the copper, they must touch the copper at a normal angle. Another crazy characteristic. The current lines in the dipole out of a strip of copper, the current lines have to be parallel to the copper, but at the outer edge. So when you start getting one step closer into what the cross-section of the field looks like on these two antennas, in either case, H-field lines are further away for a wide strip dipole. The E-field lines are further away out of the space for a wide slot antenna made in copper foil. That's part of the mechanism where the volume occupied by the E-field lines in one case and the H-field lines in the other case, greater volume is occupied by those field
repeater. Time out.
Greater volume is occupied by those field lines. That's the next step in the understanding, and it's not all the way, as to why it's got greater bandwidth. But those E field lines on the slot antenna are further out into space because the gap is bigger, and the E field lines, where they touch the near edge of the copper, must hit the copper at a normal angle. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Okay, so you talked about this wider strip antenna or wider slot antenna having a greater antenna aperture, and I guess that's, you know, you look at sort of the volume swept out by the, or the area swept out by the strip antenna or the slot antenna, and you say, okay, that's a greater area, so I guess that could be proportional to antenna aperture. And then, okay, you have more antenna aperture, therefore that affects Q and gives you, I guess, decreases Q, so it radiates better and gives you better bandwidth. So there's this relationship between aperture and bandwidth. The rest of it, again, like going back to the my thinking about the reason why frequencies happen at the surface of the conductor, I'm still not sure I get the logic of why, you know, aside from just electrons normally want to follow the shortest path, other than that, I'm not sure why there is not some magnetic effect that's going to want to push or impede electrons taking the sort of the shorter path and somehow encourage electrons in a slot antenna to go further out than the diameter of the slot. So something is not entirely clear, but I'm not sure what it is. AC2IS.
Bill, you've jumped a couple of steps ahead, and you've made an error. You've used the word aperture in a way that's wrong. When you look at the cross-section of a strip dipole antenna made out of copper foil, or you look at the cross-section of a field around the slot antenna, those fields are further in space, and the cross-section occupies greater volume in the cross-sectional diagram. Aperture, effective aperture of a dipole, is an entirely different concept. Gain equals 4 pi over lambda squared, 4 pi a over lambda squared. Rearranging those forms, those variables, a is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. A is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. A dipole antenna made out of 18-gauge wire, a dipole antenna made out of half-inch wide copper foil, both of those dipoles have the exact same gain. And the wavelength didn't change, even though the length of the foil at resonance is slightly different, 90% versus 95%. The gain didn't change. The effective capture area did not change. So, the effective capture area of a wide sheet metal dipole or a skinny wire dipole, the exact same pattern, the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area. In cross-section, the E-field lines and the H-field lines occupy a greater amount of area in the cross-sectional diagram. That area and the effective capture area of the antenna are unrelated to each other.
Repeater, timeout.
If I make the dipole very, very small, the infinitesimal dipole, it now has extremely high Q. The signal is going to bounce back and forth 100 times instead of 10 times before it finally gets radiated. The local current is going to be 100 times higher instead of 10 times higher. The local voltage is going to be 100 times higher instead of 10 times higher. So the E-field lines and the H-field lines are going to be huge in cross-section on the infinitesimal dipole. The bandwidth is going to be extremely small. The effective capture area does not change. The infinitesimal dipole and the full-length half-wave dipole, the infinitesimal dipole, you put some kind of an antenna tuner on it to force it into resonance. Once you force it into resonance, it's got the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area within half a dB. And the half a dB of difference is not a difference in performance or efficiency. The antenna pattern, the figure eight pattern that you normally see for a two-dimensional dipole antenna pattern, the figure eight pattern becomes a little bit fatter, and the peaks of it are half a dB lower. So you never lose more than a half a dB of gain when you go from a full-length half-wave dipole, down to an infinitesimal dipole. Therefore, the effective capture area never changes by more than half a dB. So you've confused effective capture area and the cross-sectional area of the... I've taken a cross-section of what's going on with the E-fields and the H-fields in these two antennas. So when I make the antenna larger in diameter for a real conducting antenna... Let me drop... Or I make the slot wider in the slot antenna in a piece of sheet metal. In cross-section, those H-field lines in one case and the E-field lines in the other case, in cross-section, they go further out into space. They occupy more area in my cross-sectional diagram. But the effective capture area of the antenna doesn't see that. Effective capture area is easier to view as to what happens when the signal is transmitted. A smaller antenna, an infinitesimal dipole, by definition has much higher currents and much higher voltages. The local E fields and H fields are much bigger. But still, after those 100 bounces on that Q of 100 infinitesimal dipole, if I've made it out of low loss material, every bit of that energy still gets radiated into space. It's a little bit equivalent if I now try to make an equivalency of I'm pushing my daughter on a swing. And I've got a very high efficient swing. I've got a good set of bearings at the top of the chain where it goes into the pivot, so to speak. And my daughter is wearing a streamlined suit, so there's very little wind loading. And she's a very high Q structure. As such, I can push her with my pinky and get her going up to full magnitude of swing. But because I'm using very little push, I may have to push her 100 times before she finally gets up to full amplitude. But she finally gets up to full amplitude. And I'm finally radiating all of that energy, if you know what I mean. It just takes longer for me to do it. By the same token, in the case of a high Q dipole, an infinitesimal dipole, it has a very long rise time and a very long fall time. Very high Q. In other words, it takes...
Repeater, timeout.
It takes me a whole lot of cycles from the transmission line to get that antenna up to full magnitude. It's got a very large magnitude, a very long rise time, and a very long fall time. A lot of stored energy in that infinitesimal dipole. In that infinitesimal dipole, 98% of that energy is stored in the antenna impedance matching network. But still, it's a high Q structure. So in either case, all the energy is radiated. But the higher the Q of the structure, the longer it takes to radiate. The longer the rise time, the longer the fall time, the more narrow the bandwidth. Bandwidth, Q, there's many definitions of Q. Center frequency divided by bandwidth is one of them. Voltage rise at the resonance, current rise at resonance, rise time and fall time, energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. In the case of that very efficient swing, when I finally get her up to full amplitude, there's a lot of stored energy on each cycle. I'm only putting in a very small pinky's worth of push on each cycle, if you know what I mean. Is some of this making a little more sense, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yes, and you, I think you had something else you wanted to move on to. So, I do have another question about effective capture area, but, you know, consider this question to be optional because we've spent a lot of time already. But you've said the infinitesimal dipole has the same capture area as a, you know, the standard full-size dipole, okay. So that's the same capture area, and then you said something about gain, so I'm thinking, okay, it's really gain that's related to capture area. The only way really to increase your capture area is by creating a high gain antenna, and then you are sort of, you know, making your antenna directional, so your capture area is only large in that one specific direction, but you've effectively traded it off in other directions. So maybe if you had some kind of 3D calculation of capture area and factored it in for all directions, again, your capture area would sort of average out. Would still be overall in all directions the same capture area. Does that make sense? AC2IS.
There's a sort of a yes and a no to that, Bill. Remember now when I told you that the infinitesimal dipole
has a much higher Q. It's got a Q of 100. The signal's going to bounce back and forth 100 times before it finally gets radiated. Only 1% of it is radiated on each bounce. Yet, after I wait long enough, every bit of that energy gets radiated. It can still run 98% efficiency when transmitting. By the law of reciprocity, every well-constructed passive dipole, every passive antenna obeys the law of reciprocity. All the factors you measure when it's transmitting, gain, bandwidth, rise time, Q, antenna pattern, directivity, all the side lobe levels, front-to-back ratio, all the parameters you measure when it's transmitting, you get the exact same parameters when you receive. So if every bit of that energy is transmitted on the infinitesimal dipole, when it's receiving, it's going to receive the exact same amount of energy. In each case, though, when you're transmitting, it's going to have a very long rise time until you get 100 cycles from that transmission line to that antenna. That antenna is not up to full amplitude, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. By the same token, when you're receiving, the signal has suddenly been turned on and you're receiving. Until you received 100 cycles of that antenna, the antenna doesn't come up to full amplitude. But when it finally comes up to full amplitude, you're going to see the exact same amount of signal within half a dB when you receive with the infinitesimal high-efficiency dipole versus the full half-wave dipole. Just that it's going to happen a lot faster on the full half-wave dipole. It's going to have a rise time in a couple of microseconds instead of milliseconds, if you know what I mean. So the craziness here is that effective capture area is only a function of gain. Assuming we're talking about high-efficiency structures with no resistive loss in it anywhere. You will develop more effective capture area when you make the gain of the antenna become higher. How do you make the gain of a dipole higher? You only get gain when you use more real estate. If I put two dipoles side by side, and I feed half my power into each one of them in phase, let me drop them. If I put them side by side, end to end, in the collinear manner, I've now got more horizontal gain. By the interferometry effect, my horizontal beamwidth probably just went down by 4 to 1. If I stack them vertically above each other, two horizontal dipoles, I've now got a smaller elevation beamwidth because I've now made a vertical interferometer. But I've used more three-dimensional real estate. The only way you get more gain is to use more real estate. You end up with more narrow pattern in at least one direction. The more narrow pattern came because of interferometry. At some particular angle off of Borsite, those two antennas are no longer co-phase with each other. You've got a longer path to the receiving site than from one antenna than the other in a off-axis direction. That's the interferometry effect. That's where the extra directivity is coming from. That's where the extra gain is coming from. And because you've got twice as many antennas there, and make up the right spacing between the two, you can see how there's more effective capture area. Each individual antenna has its normal effective capture area, and now you put two of them together. You're going to have twice the area and 3 dB of gain in the ideal case. So gain and capture area make some sense. The hard part to picture, a huge number of very smart people, including the latest issue of Microwaves and RF Magazine. Let me drop it. The author of a very well-respected article is talking about the antenna inside of a cell phone being so small, he assumes it's got 10 dB of extra loss. Good common sense, because the antenna is too small and it's hidden inside that structure. If he talked about 10 dB higher in Q and 10 dB more narrow in bandwidth, 10 dB more narrow in bandwidth, I'd agree with him. But he says it's got 10 dB lower performance in gain. He made a good common sense assumption. It's not a real measurement. That cell phone would not be qualified if it didn't pass the test for total radiated power and total isotropic sensitivity. So in the receiving mode, the antenna has to have high efficiency. In the transmit mode, the antenna has high efficiency. In order to meet the minimum requirements for total radiated power and total isotropic sensitivity. The product being sold meets those requirements. The antenna is not bound in efficiency, like he said. He forgot about some of these things. It's easy to fall into these traps because that infinitesimal dipole How in the world can it have the same gain? If I build a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132-foot-long piece of 14-gauge wire,